directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of her say. The voice of her say. The voice of her say, coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
Possible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start. If you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live. As regular listeners, you will know that our show is OWL, O-W-L, Older Women Live, is a monthly show from a feminist perspective. we continue to slowly push that agenda up that patriarchal mountainside. I'm Rosemary Wally. Today, the 9th of August, is the 78th anniversary of the US dropping of a plutonium bomb on Nagasaki. 3 days previously, a hydrogen bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima. No one knows how many people were killed, burnt, radiated, maimed for life. They estimate that in the case of Nagasaki, 80,000 people were killed immediately. For my generation, born in the 30s, 40s and 50s, this was, I suppose, our 9/11 moment, except it was much bigger. And it's never gone away. What has gone away are the protests, the resistance to war. And that's what we'll be looking at today with, surprisingly, a young woman in Vancouver, Sarah Roleda. Towards the end of the show, we'll be looking at the struggle to put food on the table and to find shelter here in Montreal with a friend and neighbour, Courtney Kirkby. We also have a little music, so stay tuned.
Sarah Roleda, thank you very much for joining us on Old Women Live for the month of August 2023. This, of course, is Hiroshima week. This is the week that when we remember the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 78 years ago. So I'm wondering, why aren't young people more involved in the struggle to eliminate nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so I think a large part of why young people haven't been getting involved in this issue is because they don't know it is one. A lot of the time in high school, when we're taught about nuclear weapons, all we hear is the days they happened, how many people died, and that it was the end of World War II. And then they kind of leave it at that. They don't give us a chance to ask questions. They don't show us the humanitarian aspect of nuclear weapons. They don't tell us about the nuclear testing that happened afterwards. They just, a lot of the time, they skip over the Cold War and that fact that Canada actually had held US nuclear weapons as well. They don't teach us any of that. And because of that, we don't have a chance to get interested. We don't have the chance to learn about how devastating this issue still is today. We don't have the chance to hear from Hibakusha, those who survived the atomic bombings, or those who have to live with the effects of nuclear testing. And all of that doesn't give us that personal connection that we need to get engaged and get involved in these issues. And people also fail to see the relevance of it today. Living in Canada, a peaceful country, and with no nuclear weapon having been exploded on a city in 78 years, people don't see that relevance. Instead, they go to climate change, which seems more relevant.
What happened in your case? How did you get involved in this issue then?
Yeah, for me, I got involved because I attended a youth nuclear peace summit in 2019 when I was 16 in Winnipeg at the Canadian Human Rights Museum. And that issue made me realize how big of an issue this still is today. It made me see all of the intersections it has with climate change, gender, and Indigenous issues. I got to hear from so many different speakers who were speaking from Indigenous communities impacted by uranium mining, from politicians who were trying to deal with these issues and trying to get the government to take action. And we also got to hear from people from Japan who are still living with these impacts. And being in that room with surrounded by youth, writing a youth treaty made us realize how much of an impact we could have. And that experience also led to so many other experiences. And I started getting involved with other groups such as Reverse the Trend, which is a group that empowers youth voices and tries to build connections with youth from the Pacific Islands, from across the world, to try and get different youth perspectives on these issues and teach us skills like writing policy papers, planning webinars, and getting other youth involved as well. And that experience led to me joining groups like Youth for TPNW, for being a... Youth for TPNW, or Youth for Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Oh, yes, I think we should say a little bit about that. That was a UN initiative that was passed in 2017, which demanded that governments stop producing and stop getting involved in nuclear weapons. I mean, it's a moral argument. It's nothing to do with manufacturing as such. But 50 countries had to sign on, and then if 50 countries signed on, it became the law. All the UN countries, and many of them did sign on, over 50. I don't know what we're up to now, but Canada did not. Why hasn't Canada signed the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons?
That's a very good question. And a large part of that is due to Canada's relationship with a lot of nuclear armed states, particularly the US, as well as being a member of NATO, and relying on NATO's reliance on nuclear deterrence and being under the nuclear umbrella posed by the US, the UK, and France, and relying on nuclear deterrence. So no other countries will attack us because we are allied with states that have nuclear weapons for fear of that retaliation, which is devastating when you think about it, because if we don't, it just allows nuclear weapons to persist, and Canada hasn't taken that action or leadership on nuclear disarmament that many of us have been fighting for them to do.
Yes, and there are about 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and I think if one goes off, that's the end of us, that's the end of everybody, because you would get, as a result, you would get ash, you would get nuclear winter. There'd be no food, there'd be nothing. And yet there are about 13,000. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I know that young people are very concerned about climate change. So what's the connection between climate change and militarism?
Yeah, so there is a huge correlation between militarism and climate change. And there's many different aspects. With our own Canadian government, the military makes up the most of its carbon emissions. The new fighter F-35 fighter jet that they plan to buy.
At $70 billion per fighter jet, right?
Yeah. Or for the life cycle cost of all of the fighter jets. And those fighter jets, they produce in an hour the same amount of carbon emissions as a car does in a year. And knowing that there could be, I think they were planning on buying 88 of those fighter jets, all of them producing that much carbon emission, in addition to all of the other military vehicles, all the other operations that produces carbon emissions, just contribute so much to Canada's carbon emissions. And a lot of that isn't included in what the government plans to do to reduce their carbon emissions. And so because of that, it allows that problem to persist and for them to keep producing all of those emissions. And a lot of the public doesn't know about that either, which limits the amount of action that people can take if they don't know about that issue. Nuclear weapons as well are devastating for the environment. Not only the radiation that causes devastating effects for the environment, but if a nuclear bomb were to be dropped, the firestorms that would result would cause a lot of carbon emissions, but also a lot of soot to go into the air, causing that nuclear winter we mentioned earlier, which would plunge the earth into cool, dry temperatures that would devastate agricultural harvests, devastate the environment, our air to breathe. That would pretty much be the end of our climate.
Absolutely, we wouldn't need to bother after that. You know, it's very sad. So where does feminism come into this, Sarah?
Yeah, so feminism intersects with this issue in a number of ways as well. First, there's the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on women. They have a higher chance of developing cancer. There's a higher chance of stillbirths and in causing malformations in children. There's so much for women, and a lot of this is still being researched as well. And women, a lot of the time, aren't involved in these discussions. A lot of the time, the discourse surrounding nuclear weapons is masculine. It's run by males who don't have the same perspectives as women. And a lot of the time, nuclear weapons and militarism is seen as masculine and strong. And countries tend to rely on that image to kind of keep up their military perspective of other countries. But, and then disarmament and peace is seen as feminine and weak. And countries detour from that because they don't want countries to see them that way. And relying on that, an issue such as nuclear, or theories such as nuclear deterrence has caused a lot of problems in trying to create peaceful solutions where people aren't hurt. Instead, we have situations where countries go into war thinking that that is the only option and deviating from the peace perspective because they see it as weak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've been involved in a few of these organizations, like the Canadian Voice of Women and Women's International Peace and Freedom. Can you tell us what some of those groups are doing and how people can maybe get the government's attention by joining those groups?
Yeah, so a lot of groups like the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada, a lot of what those organizations have been doing is starting petitions, letter writing campaigns. They've been holding webinars and different ways for the public to not only get engaged, but also learn about these issues and try and, or and as well as be able to ask questions to kind of get engaged, to find that personal connection and see the devastation that these weapons have caused and have been causing. As well, they try and launch, or my work with them as well has been involving youth perspectives, trying to get more people aware of not only youth perspectives, but international perspective as well. A lot of work that VOW does and WILF as well does is trying to make people aware of the perspective in other countries, trying to see that peace. A lot of people want peace on the agenda in all countries, in Russia, in Ukraine. In a lot of places that are war-torn, people want peace. People don't want war. And figuring out that there are those connections between people and trying to build those connections is a large part of their work as well in trying to promote peace.
So what could the older generation do for the youth in terms of reducing the risk of nuclear war, Sarah?
So I think education is a huge one. And trying to get a lot of these, a lot of education about peace building, about nuclear weapons into schools, to try and have youth learn about it as they go through school and trying to build that connection of peace building rather than just learning about war and violence. Learning about peaceful solutions, seeing that there is another way, and also learning about the ways that they can get involved, either through clubs or through classes, and trying to get them having those discussions at that age. Because of my experience at that age of having those discussions and being able to take place and learn about this with other youth, I was able to get into this work. And so giving other youth that chance and making them see this as an issue might get more youth involved, but also make it so that as they get older, they continue with it and it reduces the risk for nuclear war, because people are aware of it, because they realize how devastating these consequences are. And sharing the messages brought forth by Hibakusha and those who survived nuclear bombings and nuclear testing would really bring that personal connection and make them see how much of an impact this has had on those people's lives.
Yeah, can I ask you now about Canada's military spending, which is huge?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I feel astonished and devastated and very sad. Reading through Canada's recent budget and looking at how many pages they had spent dedicated to their military spending, to the amount of money they're spending on sending weapons to Ukraine to continue this war and this violence, rather than very few pages spent on climate change and what they're planning on doing to tackle that, but also in peace building operations. They're not much planned at all to spend on peace building through the UN or through other means. Even their feminist foreign policy, I didn't see anything really on that. I searched up woman or gender or something like that one, and only one result came up in like a small portion of something, and it was devastating just seeing the lack of concern and lack of money spent on keeping up that we have this very strong image of peace in Canada and as a peace builder, but we aren't living up to that. We aren't actually doing that work, and it was very sad and to think of what our country is doing, but also makes you wonder how the future is going to look if we continue on going on that path.
Exactly. And what about your friends and colleagues? Do they feel the same as you?
They do. Every time I bring this up with someone else, they're immediately surprised, because it's not something you pay attention to that much. Every time we do talk about it, people are surprised. They just, especially when I'm talking to international students who come here thinking Canada is that peaceful country, peaceful, peace-building country, they're very surprised to learn how much Canada actually does invest in the military, how much Canada is involved with world events, because we kind of hide behind the US and a lot of other nations that are more noticeable in war, rather than Canada's name being in a lot of those reports that people read.
Yeah, and of course, now we've got a lot of inflation, we've got a lot of unemployment, we've got poor medical services across the country, it's in shreds, we've got people, more and more people homeless every day, and yet we're spending all this money on the military. I wonder how we can get the government's attention.
That is a really good question as well, because the government just doesn't want to pay attention, and we have to make it. And a lot of the time, I think a large part of the way to do that is with youth, is by education, is by making the public more aware, and in turn, putting politicians in the room with youth, with concerned people, with people who have had to deal with these impacts, and making them realize that this is something that can't wait. It's not something that we can just say, we aren't a part of this, we can't take leadership because we're a part of another group. This can't wait. As global tensions rise, as climate change gets worse, mm-hmm. It's something that needs to happen now to prevent it from getting worse later, from a nuclear weapon being dropped and there being no return. It's not something that we can just say, oh, one will go off and that'll be okay. As long as these weapons persist, that threat will always remain, and it'll always get worse.
Yes, and apparently Canada has committed more than $8 billion to Ukraine since February 2022, since the Russian invasion. I mean, it really is over the top. And Canada is sending cluster bombs, which are illegal under international law, to the area. Well, do we have anything else to say, or is that it? I think that's it, Sarah, isn't it?
I think it is.
Do you have any final comments, anything to add? I mean, it's just so inspiring to have you, a young person like you, talking about these issues.
Amazing to be here today, too, and talking with someone who has so much experience in peace work and in so many different aspects with so many different issues, just working for this throughout your entire life. It's inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah, but you see, when we started in the early 60s, and it was relatively a short time after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were a large group of young people, you know, the baby boomers, and so there were many, many of us, and we were extremely concerned. Anyway, thank you very much, Sarah, for talking to us. And if you have anything else to add, just let me know.
I think that's everything. It's just such an amazing time to be here with you today.
And so once again, my dear Johnny, my dear friend, and so once again, you are fighting us all. And when I ask you why, you raise your sticks and cry, and I follow, my friend. How did you come to trade the fiddle for the drum? You say I have turned like the enemies you've earned, but I can remember all good things you are. And so I ask you, please, can I help you find the peace and the star? Oh, my friend, what time is this to trade the handshake for the fist? And so once again, oh, America, my friend. And so once again, you are fighting us all. And when we ask you why, you raise your sticks and cry, and we follow, my friend. How did you come to trade the fiddle for the drum? You say we have turned like the enemies you've earned, but we can remember all the good things you are. And so we ask you, please, can we help you find the peace and the star? Oh, my friend, we have all come to fear the beating of your drum.
This is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million of political prisoners in the
world. This morning, the kids had the morning news show on. Brian Campbell was talking about the fighting in Lebanon. Some senator was squawking about the bad economy. It's gonna get worse, you see. You need a change in policy. There's a local paper rolled up in a rubber band. One more sad story's one more than I can stand. Just once, how I'd like to see the headline say, not much to print today, can't find nothing better to say. Because nobody robbed a liquor store on the lower part of town. Nobody OD'd, nobody burned a single building down. Nobody fired a shot in anger, nobody had to die in vain. Sure could use a little good news today. Come home this evening, I bet that the news will be the same. Somebody takes a hostage, somebody steals a plane. How I want to hear the anchor man talk about a county fair and how we cleaned up the air, how everybody learned to care.
My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
Okay, are we ready? I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
I've lived in this area for over 50 years. This is an area near downtown Montreal. And the reason that I live in this area, it's not that I chose it, but it was just very cheap when I first came to Montreal. The houses were in terrible condition because they were all from the end of the 19th century. So, of course, by the time I arrived in 1971... they were falling apart in many cases, but the rents were cheap and the places were quite big and it was a fairly safe area. And it was very convenient, so it was full of, you know, there were a lot of grocery stores, there were hospitals, there were schools, there were all the things that you would need to have kids. But things have changed, and so for your generation, tell me, Courtney.
Yeah, so we were just talking about... I guess that it's really the cost of living crisis that everybody is feeling more and more, the squeeze that's happening. I was listening to the news last night about the grocer protests.
Oh, the strike, the metro strike at the metro company.
Exactly. Yes. Of people saying that they can't even afford the groceries at the store they work at. And, you know, there's been, I think there was a commission or an investigation at the level of the federal government into Galen West and Loblaws and that whole enterprise. And nothing really seemed to come of it, but, and they kept making excuses about why the prices were going up, inflation, the cost of energy and different things. And yet they boasted, I think it was $500 million as profit for the last year. So we know that they're having like record-breaking profits, and it's coming at the cost of the majority of the country struggling to get groceries. So the other thing that we've been looking at, there was a new announcement made just a few days ago about Airbnb and the fact that Montreal is claiming that they're finally going to get serious about investigating and shutting down Airbnbs.
Yeah, so what's the connection between the Airbnbs and the very high cost of groceries and rent and everything?
Well, there's a... I think it's about not being able to get an apartment. So as supply is reduced, because there's over 8,000 Airbnbs, and I think about over 7,000 of them are the entire apartment or home. So that's over 7,000 families that are not having access to housing that would normally be there. So we know that the cost of apartments has been going up, also in sort of huge accelerated spikes, and that people are struggling to pay their rent. I think it's 1 in 5 families pays their rent on credit.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, it's not sustainable. So I think it's the whole cost of living.
It's definitely not sustainable.
It's a few profiteers that are kind of pushing everyone into the ground in a way. And we see it. We see the rising homelessness.
Yeah, we see people sleeping in the parks. I mean, it happens to be the summer now.
Yeah, it's growing.
You wonder what's going to happen in the winter. Yeah, people sleeping in the parks.
And we know that in Montreal, about 56% of the listings are illegal. And they just haven't done anything until it took, you know, 7 people dying in a Montreal
That's
fire.
Right. That was in March. There was a fire in Old Montreal, and seven people died because the apartments were didn't have sprinklers, and they were not supposed to be. They were not tourist destinations.
Yeah, and so now there's a squad. It has 2 people, and I think a 3rd person is joining, and they're going to be doing the investigation. So they don't have much teeth. They can only fine $1,000, which when you're making, you know, thousands and thousands per month is very little. Oh, I got a baby here. But what they can do then is tip off Revenue Quebec to illegal listings, and then Revenue Quebec has the power to fine up to $100,000 for a more corporate, or I think it's $50,000 for an individual. So that becomes a little more realistic in terms of the relationship to the profits that people are making illegally.
Yeah, I mean, Revenue Quebec also has the power to claim taxes from these individuals that are using their homes to make profit.
So what's happening, though, is that Airbnb at a certain point added taxes. So people are paying Quebec taxes even if they're running an illegal Airbnb.
What, they're paying income tax on their income? This is income that they're earning.
Yeah, I don't know how the income works. I mean, some people, I think, hide it, and then some people probably pay it, but they don't list it as an Airbnb, obviously. They probably list it as something else when they have their income taxes done.
Okay. So what do you think the solution is?
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what this squad does, and actually, you know, having the government protect the majority of Canadians, which doesn't seem to be happening, you know. When we look at climate change, we see that the Canadian government just gave more fossil fuel industry subsidies.
Exactly.
Knowing that we've had the hottest summer on record in, you know, over 100,000 years. But I think we're coming to the moment now where I think people were kind of getting by and were able to keep their head in the sand. But now it feels like everything's coming to the head. So we have exactly the hottest summer on record. We have inflation, and we have like the grocery store profiteering that's just so transparent.
Yeah, we have wildfires absolutely everywhere.
And everyone, you know, you see you can't get an apartment, and then you see more and more lockboxes on Airbnbs.
Exactly.
So I think that it's coming to the point where governments are seeing that it's an issue that's going to affect whether or not they stay in power. And I think, you know, we can blame governments, but it's also our actions and our voices that kind of push them to make policies that they think will keep them in power or not. Mm-hmm. So if we're not active enough on the streets, then they're going to be going more with the lobbyists who have their ear and have a lot of money mm-hmm. to push them mm-hmm. to do certain things.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing that they're spending our money on, I mean, I know we're not going to talk about this, but we've talked a little bit, is armaments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Lockheed Martin isn't homeless. They get lots and lots of money, of our money, to kill people, including using cluster bombs, which is illegal under international law. So,
yeah, and I think we see too, you know, what the fighter jets that were just bought for $70
billion. And each. Yes.
And when we look at the, you know, they talk about how bringing back the trains that would go to every city in the country, it's too expensive because it would cost $27 billion. So it's a small fraction of the fighter jet cost, and it would be a massive help to our fossil fuel emissions. It would bring them down a lot if everyone could go by train versus car.
Cool.
So I think the money is there. It's just the political will. So I don't know. I think it's time to get in the streets.
Absolutely, I do too. I mean, if we're in the streets en masse, they're going to take notice. But if we're not, they don't. They can easily ignore the problems, which is what they've been doing.
Masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can see through your mask, you that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand, you hide from my eyes. Then you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten their triggers for others to fire, and you sit back and watch. When the death count gets higher, you hide in your mansion as young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can never be hurled, the fear to bring children into the world. Or threaten my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? to talk out of turn. You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. There's one thing I know, though I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your debt takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
Hi, my name is Debi, storyteller, dub poet, partly raised in Montreal, 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 launching my new CD 333. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Mary Shad Curry. Born a free black in Wilmington, Delaware, in 1823, within a family active in the Underground Railroad, Mary Shad Carey was an educator, a writer and editor, an abolitionist, a women's rights advocate, and a suffragist. She founded several schools for both black and white students, the first when she was only 16, and served as a teacher and principal in many others. In 1851, she moved to Canada and established herself in Windsor, where she lived most of the second half of her life.
Le matin, mon cadran est à CKUT. Pendant le déjeuner, j'écoute CKUT. En me rendant au travail, j'écoute CKUT.
Pourquoi quelques yeux clairs veulent tout casser?
Au travail, on écoute tous CKUT. Pendant que je prépare le souper, c'est CKUT. Plus tard, pour relaxer, je syntonise CKUT. Et dans mon lit, j'écoute encore CKUT. CKUT! CKUT! Je capote sur toi.
Tout ça au 90.3 FM à Montréal.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Words mental illness. What do you think?
I have friends who don't even know that I suffer from depression.
Why don't they know?
Because I'm scared they'll ostracize me if they know, and then they'll abandon me. I don't want to be alone.
You're discriminated against when you have a mental illness. With other illnesses, there's compassion.
It doesn't take much to be diagnosed mentally ill.
Due to an outburst, I was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And now the doctors say it's something else.
20% of people and counting have had or will have a depression.
People throw different labels around. You're this or you're that.
Everybody psychoanalyzes someone during a conversation.
You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, Amy Quebec, Ford House, or Prevention Suicide.
The most violent element in society is ignorance. Born in 1869 in the Jewish quarter of Kovno, Lithuania, Emma Goldman emigrated to the United States at the age of 16 in the hopes of escaping a traditional domestic life, in which her only use, in her father's opinion, would be to cook and produce many children for her man. Once in New York, where she worked in the garment industry, she was inspired to adopt a life of activism after witnessing the 1887 Haymarket Square riot, which led to the execution of falsely accused anarchists. She then began her career as an anarchist speaker and activist. Addressing crowds in either Yiddish, German, or English, she was a fiery and captivating orator who was not afraid of tackling such controversial issues as sexual freedom and contraception. She published her own anarchist journal, Mother Earth, from 1906 to 1917. Unimpressed by the women's suffrage movement, Goldman wrote, "Corruption in politics has nothing to do with the morals or the laxity of morals of various political personalities. Its cause is altogether a material one. Politics is the reflex of the business and industrial world. There is no hope that woman, with her right to vote, will ever purify politics." She was sentenced to a year in prison in 1893 for one of her speeches and was deported back to Russia in 1919 for being an undesirable immigrant radical. Unable to live with the restrictions on political expression and the anti-Semitism of Bolshevik Russia, Goldman spent the rest of her life in exile in Europe and Canada. Emma Goldman died in Toronto in May of 1940.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kassler. My name is Gennargio Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Our next speaker here is Viola Thomas. She is also a residential school survivor.
Part of our obligation where I work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada is to inform Canadians on the truth. But I believe that as more Canadian people understand that this was Canadian law and Canadian policy, and that Canadians need to take responsibility for the shared history, I also believe that Canadians have a responsibility to resonate reconciliation with the First Peoples of this country. And what did we learn when we went to the school? We learned how to be bullies, how to be mean to each other, how not to love, how not to feel a great sense of pride of who you are and where you come from. I learned about racism, and I didn't know what that was. I really didn't know what racism was. I learned about sexism, and as a young girl, I didn't know about sexism. There were many forms of abuse, not just the physical, but the intellectual abuse. To always be reminded that you're stupid and that you're nobody. To be told by your teachers and by the folks from the church that you're a savage, you're a squaw. And I just want to close with one of my heroes, a woman by the name of Winona LaDuc. And I offer this to all of our brothers and sisters who were abducted to residential schools. And I offer this with a good heart to non-Indigenous people so that they will pick up the torch. And this is what she says. There is no social change fairy. There is only change made by the hands of individuals.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
De l'argent, t'as déjà de faire peur de ton temps à pousser dans le dos des gens, mes mains blanches. Se croisent les doigts pour l'arrogance. Serrer celle du diable avant d'aller à l'abattoir, avant de décevoir mes mains blanches. Mes mains blanches ont toujours eu les coups des franches. Mes mains blanches n'ont jamais relevé mes manches. De la guitare ben slack, pour être juste à côté de la traque, pour pas taper sur le 2 pis le 4, pour dire salut c'est moi pis j't'ai encore scrap. Si t'as besoin d'une claque, y'aura toujours mes mains blanches. Church on Sunday morning, Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast, might fall on a piece of glass, might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hand. The local unwed mother, Grandma's hand used to ache sometimes and swell. Grandma's hand used to lift her face and tell her, she'd say, baby, Grandma, understand that you really love that man. Put yourself in Jesus' hands, Grandma's hand. Used to hand me a piece of candy. Grandma's hand picked me up each time I fell. Grandma's hand, boy, they really came in a handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for
Restaurant located in the heart of downtown Montreal, 1236 Mackay Street, Suite 201. For reservations, please call 514-875-7082 or visit mangobay.ca. Real food.
Let's get together and feel all right.
When you see or hear the word conservation, it is often popularly used to discuss ecosystems, landscapes, and species. Historically, however, very rarely is it used in reference to the people who inhabit those ecosystems. How land becomes protected, or how it doesn't, is a long and sometimes violent story, especially in the Congo Basin and Central Africa. It often involves the displacement and deaths of local and indigenous communities, the exploitation of natural resources for political or economic gain, and armed groups decimating wildlife. People who have inhabited these lands for centuries often are faced with aggressive measures by state and private entities to heavily regulate their use of that land on behalf of conservation. This contentious model is often referred to as fortress conservation, and it is at the heart of a debate on how to best preserve the natural ecosystems of the Congo Basin. A debate that has historically left locals out of the conversation. But that is beginning to change. I'm Mike DiGirolamo. This is Mongabe Explores, a podcast series about our world's unique places, species, and the people working to save them. You're listening to episode 2 of our 4th season, Mongabe Explores the Congo Basin. In this episode, we dive into the complex topic of fortress conservation and the